this week's episode of The Freenoter, our first sequel, Getting the Gigs Part 2.
We'll give a shout out to Grant Baldwin and what he can teach us about booking speeches.
And in the spirit of this, our first podcast sequel, a cocktail sequel, The Corpse Reviver Number 2.
All that and more on this week's episode of The Freenoter.
So, we're doing a sequel.
We are.
And this sequel, unlike Hollywood sequels, is absolutely going to be exactly the same as the first one.
We're going to talk about everything the
same. It's just going to be equally great.
Well, absolutely it is.
No better and no worse.
No.
No, we're going to talk a little bit more about getting the gigs because we've had, we did an episode earlier on how to actually get talks, how to break in and find speeches and get on stage.
Yeah, and we talked a lot about on that one about submitting proposals and things like that.
So we're going to look at a different aspect of it here, a little more outbound, let's say, a little more effort on the part of the speaker.
Efforting.
We're going to do some efforting. We're going to talk a little bit about agents and bureaus. We're also going to revisit.
Spies.
Like spies. Secret speaker man. Secret speaker man. I will not edit that out in post.
Nor should you.
And last week, we quickly brought up Grant Baldwin's new book, The Successful Speaker, and he's got a bit in there to teach us about finding the gigs, going out and actively grabbing them.
Yes, which I think automatically makes him our real hero of speaking.
So we're going to get to that. And then, of course, as we mentioned at the top of the show, we have a sequel of A Cocktail. But let's talk about Getting the Gigs Part 2.
Well, I had a friend of mine, Adam Zand, reach out to me on Facebook, and the question he had was actually about speaking agents, because he was very excited about a project that he's been working on with his partner in business, Greg Peverell Conti, I believe is the correct way to say it. And they have been doing a lot of speaking, but they've actually now started to flip their freenoting into keynoting about this, where people have asked them to come in and talk about this project they've been doing, I believe on library land, mm-hmm. on libraries. And he was curious about what role, like if such a thing as a speaker agent exists. And I told him the answer is yes. And I was like, huh, you know, I bet other people have this question if they're thinking about using speaking as a way of driving business. You know, they probably have more specific questions of like, well, I know I can effort, but can I hire somebody else to effort? And how does that work? So that's a quick backstory on that. I mean, I've seen it handled a number of different ways. I'm curious, you at Edison get a lot of inbound inquiries.
Entirely inbound.
And I've worked at organizations in the past where we have done the work to go find those. And usually, I remember when I worked at a wonderful brand strategy and design firm called Samets Blackstone here in Boston, there was really, finding and applying to these things was the task of somebody in the office. And I think that's one of the simplest ways to get started is to, if you've got somebody in your office, whether that's you or an assistant or something like that, where they can do some of that preliminary research, find out when the deadlines are and all of that. I think that can be super, super helpful. And when we start talking a little bit later today about Grant Baldwin's book, there's some great ideas there. But I think one of the first things is to really commit to the fact that you're going to do this for your business. And like all things you're going to commit to do for your business, start to commit resources for it, for your business. Time, money, tracking, those kinds of things.
All right. So that's someone who goes and finds gigs for you. Maybe that's you. Maybe that's someone in your office. Is that what a speaker agent does? Is that the same thing?
So I don't have a speaker agent, but this, yes, in theory, that's exactly what a speaker agent does. That a speaker agent, much like an acting agent or something, operates on your behalf and advocates for you and helps you go find gigs, and often is the person who handles all the client interactions and those kinds of things. And so some people may be thinking, speaker agents, what's the difference between those and speaker bureaus? Well, bureaus are, think of them as like an agency, right? It's like a bureau is where meeting professionals go. They talk to the bureau and say, hey, who do you have that speaks on this topic? Or sometimes they say, we specifically want this person, and that person is represented by that bureau. And then the bureau is the one that handles all the contracting and the travel arrangements and the fee collecting and all of that kind of good stuff. And oftentimes what's happening if there's an agent involved is the agent is representing their speaker to the bureau to try to get the bureau to represent that speaker. So there's all these layers that exist out there. And generally what I found is that I think people think that bureaus and agents are going to do a lot more for them than I have seen them do, particularly if you're fairly early on in your freenoting career. The only exception of that is if you're somehow famous. Because if you're somehow famous, like you've done a thing, you have achieved a thing that people know about, like saw on TV or something like that, it's very unusual that a bureau or even an agent would come looking for you. Mm. I mean, generally, the rule of thumb that I've heard from both agents and bureaus is, don't call us, we'll call you. And so I think that the best thing to be thinking about is how can you operate as your own agent, or how can you get somebody who does, you know, how can you get someone who operates like that on your behalf so that they are fielding inbound inquiries, they are tracking those things for you, they are, in a lot of cases, doing outbound research on, you know, where could you be speaking, what are those conferences, those kinds of things, managing the kind of technical aspect of it, and just keeping those records. So does that answer your question about kind of the difference between, or do you think that covers the answer of agents, bureaus?
You know, I think so, but I'm left with one question, because, you know, you and I know a lot of professional speakers, and you're a professional speaker. Do freenoters need to worry about bureaus at all? Is this something that a freenoter should care about?
So I know a couple of freenoters who are freenoting because they're philanthropic, and they are in fact bureaus. But I mean, generally, a bureau isn't going to want to represent you if you're free.
That's not how they get paid.
That's not how they get paid, right? Like, that's the thing to remember, is that kind of by definition, if you're freenoting, you are not needing, and you know, an agent, you will not be of interest to an agent or a bureau, because they take, you know, somewhere between 10 and 25% generally of a cut off the top of your fee. And if you're just like, hey, I'm just doing this to, you know, get business, they're going to be less interested. Mm-hmm. At the same time, bureaus, from what I understand, like to have a range of fee options for folks. So if you have a champagne dreams, but you know, whatever the other one is.
Caviar wishes.
Caviar wishes, champagne dreams. But you know, caviar wishes on an anchovy budget, then that it's sometimes useful for them to be like, oh, okay, well, you know, we know that you love, you know, Nancy Duarte, but Nancy Duarte, let's say, is $30,000, $40,000. They like having folks in the $20,000 range and the $15,000 and the $10,000 and sometimes down to $7,500. Generally, my understanding is that they don't really agents or bureaus don't represent folks really below $7,500.
And this week's episode of The Freenoter is brought to you by anchovies. Anchovies, a welcome relief from the delicious.
So, I mean, I think it's probably best for us to turn our attention to a little bit more of what are some of the tasks that somebody who, either you yourself or somebody who works for you can do. I know one of the things that we kind of mentioned in passing last time we talked about getting the gigs was, you know, is it worth it and all of that. And I forgot to mention at the time that I, once upon a time when I was working in an organization, put together a spreadsheet that worked as a little calculator to figure out whether or not a particular gig was worth it. And I'm happy to share that with everyone. And basically what it did was assign kind of a numerical value to the opportunity and collected for you what the hard costs would be and allowed you to figure out like your hourly time. Cause in this case, I was working at an advertising agency. I actually had an hourly rate, what my time was worth. And then you could compare the outbound revenue, you know, or opportunity costs, like both soft and hard costs of attending the event, against the score that we gave it as far as whether or not it was going to be strategically valid. So I think that's a kind of a complicated way to do it. I know, since I mentioned Sammons Blackstone already, one of the ways that they figured it out was that there was always they had a kind of a faster, better, cheaper pick two kind of analysis on gigs. And generally the way they thought about it was that a gig needed to be strategically advantageous, creatively advantageous, or financially advantageous, and you needed two out of three. So it, you know, and this is the way that they chose what work to do, but it also came in handy when an opportunity to speak came up, because it was the same kind of application we put against it. Does it make sense for us to be there? Mm-hmm. Because it's strategically important to us. And I think you and Edison do a lot of that.
Very much. Yeah. I mean, when I'm looking at a gig, the first thing I'm looking at is this an audience that is a reach for me? Do I aspire to speak to this audience? Or is this an audience that's sort of in my current wheelhouse?
Yeah.
Or is this an audience that's not in my current wheelhouse? And either it's one that is sort of tangential, or it's not of strategic interest to me necessarily, right? And I will go through more hoops and I will undergo more inconveniences to get a gig if it's something that I'm aspiring, if it's an audience I'm aspiring to reach that maybe I haven't reached yet, right?
Right.
Yeah, I will take a certain amount of those kinds of pains for an audience that I'm serving right now. And if it's an audience that, you know, is not really strategically that important, maybe it's nice to get reps. I mean, I have a few rules about that. Like, I'll do it, but that has to have travel and expenses included. And I really, on those things, am really starting to say no to multiple track sessions.
Yeah.
Because I find I don't do as well. You know, if I'm in a field that's really not completely in my wheelhouse, I'm very likely going to be put up against people for whom it is that are right. Maybe stars in that particular
and
area.
giving a good solid tactical breakout kind of session. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my talks will, by attendance, suffer. And so I tend to say no to those. But if it's, again, something that, you know, I know my company wants to get to, then I'll go speak in front of 12 people. Maybe next year it'll be 25 and I'll keep building on that.
Yeah. I think, you know, kind of two extremes, it's a great way to think about it is, you know, can you come up for yourself what, let's say, your two out of three criteria need to be? Like, what is important to you? Because I know from a creative standpoint, I'll free note, or more specifically T&E note, if it's an opportunity for me to test out new material. This, I think, is something we've talked about before. Because it's not that I don't care about that audience, but it's that makes the balance. I mean, I do care about that audience. In fact, it's one of those things that it's the audiences that I love and trust the most that are the ones I often will try out new material with. Mm-hmm. Let's say like B2B marketing forum from Marketing Profs or Content Marketing World in Cleveland. Those are both places where, by and large, I've debuted new material, and that's part of my thinking when I analyze that. So it's not just, am I going to make a fee, you know, if that's important, or, you know, from the standpoint of a business, is the outgoing cost going to be worth it? I think just having that kind of, is it financially going to be worth it? Is it strategically going to be worth it? And is there kind of whatever your third thing is? I think it's just, that's a nice simple way to do it. And with the spreadsheet that I came up with when I was working at Allen & Gerritsen, that I basically just took that and took it to 11 a little bit. It basically said, these are, I think it was five different criteria that something had to score, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, it had to score like a 4 or 5 on these different five, you know, these different criteria, and be worth it financially in order for us to do it. So that meant, for instance, that it was much more likely that I would do something at, say, Inbound from HubSpot here in Boston, because the time out of the office, you know, there wasn't travel expenses out of pocket. Mm-hmm. It was literally across the street from the office, and everything else scored well, except that otherwise would have been an expensive thing. But because I could just like pop out over lunch, basically, it made a lot of sense to do that.
So let's talk a little bit about, again, about finding the gigs.
Yep.
And, you know, we started off this discussion with what, you know, either you might do yourself or what an assistant might do, to help you actually find the places to go talk. And I wanted to mention, you know, I mentioned earlier that, yeah, so much of what we do is inbound, but actually that's not 100% true. I mean, we have done, you know, a lot of our inbound work is streaming audio and podcasting and politics and some of the things that we've been known to work on for the past, you know, 25 years at Edison.
Yep.
3 or 4 years ago, we started to break into voice assistant, smart speaker, those kinds of topics, which is certainly in our wheelhouse strategically, you know, because we are all about audio, but that's a whole different, you know, it's a whole different group of people that talk about those things, whole different, you know, audiences, different.
Much more of a tech audience.
Much more of a tech audience, yeah. And so it was, even though it was tangential, I don't know if it's what our friend Drew Davis would call a fractal, but it's not light years from what I was already doing. It was sort of opening up into a new branch of different types of events and conferences. And so I'll just talk about what we do. And I do have someone that helps with that in our office. Shout out Laura Ivy, if you're listening, because she has this giant, we use Airtable for collaboration. She has a giant Airtable of this stuff. And like in the early days, it just started with Google. It started Googling, you know, voice conference and things like that.
And that is such a great, that is just a great basic way to start. It's just say topic and conference and do a search string on that.
Topic and conference, topic and event, topic and convention. If you're not doing that, then that's the base hygiene to do this.
And then the second place to just notch up from there, I'm not sure if Laura does this or not, is that I have a series of Google alerts, though I actually use a service called TalkWalker alerts, which I find is just more comprehensive, where I have a Boolean search string of looking for a speaker, nominated speaker, plus topic areas, so that even if it's just, I get actually a regular drip of conferences that are looking for certain types of speakers. So that's a way to take the work down a little bit, right? So you can sit down and do it all in one big go, but then also set up some kind of alert system. So when those new calls for proposals come out, because that's generally what we're doing as freenoters is answering those calls for proposals or calls for submissions. It's just a great way to know what's coming out.
Mm-hmm. So the sort of next level from that, which we do, and I'm going to recommend something that it's going to sound sinister.
What?
It's human stalking.
What? Human stalking? What do you mean by that?
I will tell you exactly what I mean by that. So I've been lucky enough to, there's a conference called the Voice Summit. There was one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. The West Coast one was just at CES. And I've been fortunate enough to give the keynote at both of them. I look very carefully at who else is on the docket of those particular conventions and conferences. And I look to see where else they're going.
Mm.
What are they doing? You know, a good friend of mine in voice, Brett Kinsella, who Brett, I know listens to the show, has a company called VoiceBot AI. He's a great journalist in the space and does research as well. And like, I look to see where Brett's going, not to take his spot or, you know, by no means. We share the stage a lot, but like, if he's going somewhere, I should know it.
Right.
I should know what that conference is.
Yeah. Overlapping Venn diagrams. That was going to be my next level suggestion as well, is what I call lookalike speakers.
Yeah.
So know who, you know, starting with a conference or two that you're in, or conference, you know, speakers that you know, yes, go look and see what other conferences they're speaking at, and then figure out what the process is for getting onto that stage. If you know those people personally, then it's always worth asking for an introduction.
Yeah.
I understand, though, a lot of folks, I mean, that is the best way, by the way, to get additional speaking gigs, is to get referred by a speaker at that gig. Understand, though, a lot of speakers are not comfortable doing that unless they've seen you speak. So it's just one of those things, as like most things, you know, build the relationship first before you make some kind of ask. But it's useful to know who's in your ecosystem, who are you similar to. Now, that may sound kind of counterintuitive, like, well, why would I want to look for people who are similar? Because it's not all that common for a speaker to have a whole series of talks where they can come back and speak year after year after year. So it's much more likely that person takes a year off or 2 years off before the event would want them to come back. And if you've got topics that notch in really well behind somebody else, that's very useful. So for instance, I know that my red thread talk, or even my conversational case talk, is a really good follow-on for some organizations or associations that have already had some of the great storytelling speakers in there, because those storytelling speakers have already set the groundwork. I know this is already an organization that understands storytelling, and they're probably looking for, well, what do we do now? How do we operationalize it? Or we've gotten this piece that's working well, but how do we do something different? So it's been useful to me to track that way and to be able to be in a position to say, oh, okay, well, you know, if you had Kendra Hall, then I might be a good fit for the next time around. Or if you had Robert Rose or Donald Miller, like, these are all speakers that I know I I'm a good follow up to, not only from an energy level, but also from a material standpoint. So finding those quote unquote lookalike speakers is a great way to go, just to find opportunities and discover conferences and events that you didn't know about.
Mm-hmm. And some, you know, another thing to look at is not just speakers and where else they're speaking, but who sponsors these events and what else are they sponsoring? And do you know any of these sponsors? Do you know any of these sponsors? I mean, I've gotten into events because I've known some of the sponsors and I've, you know, I've said, hey, can you put in a good word for me? I'd love to speak at this conference and they've done it. And
yeah, you've mentioned that before. Yeah. I think that kind of that pay to play aspect of it, but that's a great way, particularly if you're in a position, as I often was in my organizations, where my organization didn't want to pay. Mm-hmm. But if you have a relationship with the sponsor's already paying, and they usually have either no interest or no idea what they would do with the speaking slot that came along with it, or they know that everybody usually like rolls their eyes and groans mm-hmm. at the sponsor slots. And so for you to be able to step in and like really make that sponsor shine, and you can do things like you can go to their booth afterwards, and so people can do that Q&A there, and then you're bringing traffic to their booth and all of that, and that is a great way. That's a great suggestion, is to go think about where you know sponsors, and what if you're working with an organization, if you're working for a company, what are the companies that you work with, and what can you use some of those business relationships that are already existing?
Well, and even, you know, just relationships are such a big part of it. I mean, I, you know, as you and many of our listeners know, I've served the podcast space for a very long time, and you know, so many of the people in the podcast space that have sort of risen up and grown up with it and now have thriving businesses, they remember that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've keynoted 5 or 6 different, they're called Podfront events. They're like an upfront, in the TV season, but basically a whole bunch of podcast networks get together, invite a whole bunch of agency people to come for a day of showing off their wares. And, you know, for the last 5 or 6, they've invited me to kick that day off because I'm a known quantity.
Mm.
I represent a name that the agency people will know, and they know that I'm just going to come in. I'm going to hit my marks. I'm going to be on and off the stage in 20 minutes. People will start the day with a smile and a little bit of data, and it's a good day, right? And so just being reliable.
That's how I judge a good day.
That's how I judge a good day. Hit your marks.
Smile, get a little bit of data.
Get a little bit of data.
It's all good.
Yeah. But that really is about serving a constituency as well as you can. And even if you're not yet speaking for that constituency, how else can you serve that constituency well?
Yeah.
So that they will take notice of you and maybe that chance will come.
Yeah. So we've talked about how you can potentially yourself and what you yourself can do, or what you can ask someone on your team or in your company to help you do. We've mentioned a couple tools. So you said that Laura Ivey uses Airtable. Mm-hmm. Jen and I use a product that's in beta right now, that's being produced by Drew Davis, our good friend, called Gigs, which is tracking gigs and, you know, collecting all the data on those. So we've talked about what you can do yourself. We've talked about what you can do with your business relationships. I talked a little bit about where you can go to find some of these things. So we've talked about some tools like Talkwalker alerts, Google alerts, Airtable, Google spreadsheets, the spreadsheet that I put together. And there are, you know, there are businesses and companies out there that are set up to help as well. And so I think it's probably worth mentioning that is some of those. You know, the one that is off the top of my head, is Sean Rhodes' company does things like that, where you can hire them to go find some of the gigs for you, do that research. I know Jen does that work freelance as well for mm-hmm. other speakers. So JenMonfort.com. So she does that on behalf of not only on behalf of me, but on some of the clients that she works with, because she also works with Nick Morgan and Public Words. I think that it's useful to know too that there are, you know, VAs, you know, virtual assistants that exist to do this work. And I know that there are VAs that's what they do. That's that they've that is their, that's the core competency they've built up. There's some that are even specific to helping you find, sort, and apply to TEDx events. And so one of the places I would start with those folks is a friend, client, and I've been a client of hers, Melissa Smith, runs a company. Well, she's at thepva.com. She's basically a virtual assistant matchmaker. So she can help you find people who can do that. And so, and a lot of times, again, if you just, if you don't have the time or patience to do all that research yourself, even don't have the time or patience to find a person, then she's a person who can help you find the person. So I think that's, those are all, I think, some good tactical things that people can do to get the gigs.
Well, you know who else has some good tactical things people can do to get the gigs?
Grant Baldwin?
Grant Baldwin, this week's real hero of speaking. Grant has a new book out called The Successful Speaker, and it really is pitched towards the person looking for paid speaking gigs. But there's a good section in there about how to find those gigs, and I think it's applicable whether you're looking for paid gigs or free notes or whatever in between looks like.
And what I actually really appreciate about his book, and I think I mentioned this on the last episode, is that he's got this five-letter acronym that it's, that his system is all based on. And by the way, Grant is one of those folks that runs a company that helps you learn how to build the business of speaking. So he runs a great company, has a great podcast called The Speaker Lab. And this book is a compendium of essentially that process and that program. And so if you're looking to find help with that, I mean, Grant's folks, and this is not a paid endorsement, this is just a, I know folks that have been
very
happy.
No, we're brought to you by anchovies, don't forget, not Grant Baldwin.
I just know folks that have worked with Grant and work and are active coaches with Grant, and those are people whom I respect. But the thing I wanted to mention about this acronym is that, you know, it's S-P-E-A-K, as you would imagine, and select a problem to solve, prepare and deliver your talk, establish your expertise. And number four is acquired paid speaking gigs. And right there, he won me over in a big old way, because basically saying, listen, you actually have to go out there and do a thing before you can ever think about getting paid for it. But even if you're not interested in getting paid for it, the things that he's talking about how to find those gigs are really, really useful.
Yeah. And he talks a lot. I mean, we've already mentioned Google. But one of the things he talks about is SEO, search engine optimization. And you might think about, even if you're a freenoter, even if you are a speaker for your company and not attempting to get, you know, kind of paid keynotes, about having at least a speaker page, if not a whole website, devoted to being findable for speaking about the thing that you speak about. And I think that's something that a lot of the corporate speakers I know, the corporate kind of freenoters in my world, I don't think they know to do that. I don't think they know to do that. And it's a simple thing, I think, for your company to help you position yourself as a speaker through search engine and through, you know, what's on even your company's website, so that you can be findable for keywords, because that's a huge part of it.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that he talks about a lot is referrals. And we talk about getting speaker to speaker referrals. And ideally, you want to get meeting organizer to meeting organizer referrals. But don't forget that your clients are potentially referrals as well. But just because they know and working with you, they're much, much more likely to give you a warm intro or a warm lead to somebody. And I just, I love Grant's focus on that. And I love that he's very specific about how do you reach out, and even gives very specific information about, like, what the email should talk about, how often you should follow up, and, you know, what's a great way to do it, and when should you call, and should you call, and all of those things. And I just, that's just, it's rare that there's such a nice, clean, step-by-step plan out there. I don't know any other book that does that. And so I think the fact that he's got this out there, I think this is going to be, literally, I think this is going to be one of those Bibles of speaking that people are going to refer to for many years to come. Because it's rational, it's approachable, and it really isn't just about paid speaking. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's obviously the big not secret here, the freenoter, is that we talk about what to do just to speak, even if you're not getting paid for it. But hopefully the advice is good for everybody, even including those who are getting paid for it. I do want to give a shout out to one other book, though, that I think is a really great compendium of very tactical things. And that's by my friend, Tim David. And he wrote a book called Get Speaking Gigs.
What's it about, Tamsin?
What's it about? And what I like about that is that I think it's a nice companion to Grant's book as well. I think Tim's book is really aimed towards the DIY person, or can also be, as I've done with Jen, I literally handed her the book and said, this, you know, this is,
go and do likewise.
Go and do likewise. Because it is that specific, because like I said, Tim is really focused on the DIY approach. And the more that you've got that, the easier it is to put it in place for yourself.
Well, this has been a great sequel.
It has been a great sequel.
It's been a great sequel. And so I think we should honor that with a cocktail that is a sequel.
I've got a burning question about it. You know what's coming, but let's tell him what's the cocktail, Tom?
So today we're enjoying the Corpse Reviver number 2, and it sounds like some kind of necromancy.
You know, it doesn't, I don't think the flavor of it matches its name.
No.
At all.
No.
No, it tastes, well, my first, and I've had it before, but was reminded today when you made it. And I'm like, it has a strong country time finish, country time lemonade finish.
Country time remembers.
So did the zombies.
Yes, so the Corpse Reviver number 2 was actually from the 1930s, the Savoy.
Oh, lovely.
And yeah. The Savoy had a series of these, and this is the one that has survived because it's the one that tastes good.
So is that what happened to the Corpse Reviver first? One of the people were like, this is undrinkable, I can't stand it.
Yeah, well, it came from...
Did it get stomped at the Savoy?
It got stomped at the Savoy. Well, originally they were hangover cures.
Corpse Reviver. Oh, no, yeah, that makes a lot of
it
sense.
It is the hair of the dog, what bit you?
With a country time finish.
With a little country time finish, yeah. Just a whiff of Yankee Candle. Well, yeah, so there was a Corpse Reviver 1, a number 2, and a 2A. I don't know why they didn't make it to 3, I guess.
That's like PIMS. It stayed in beta. PIMS number 1 and PIMS number 7.
There's 20 PIMS.
Show me the store that serves them.
Like, I think only at the PIMS factory.
Can you still get all the other PIMSs?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think like PIMS number 20 just tastes like dirt. Just okay. Dirt.
All right, we're cheating on our Corpse Reviver.
We're cheating on
cocktail.
Our Corpse Reviver number 2. This is the one that has remained, and you'll see this on the menu, whether it sounds familiar to you or not. If you go to a really good classic cocktail bar, it will absolutely be on the menu. And the country time lemonade aspect of it comes from lemon juice.
It was good, yes, not good. Actual country time.
Right. So it's simple to make in the same way that the last word is. It's equal parts gin, Cointreau, which is an elevated orange liqueur, La Lille Blanc, which is just a dry vermouth, and lemon juice.
Yeah.
And you shake all that over ice. You shake it because it's got the juice. You always shake the things with the juice in it.
Polaroid picture.
Shake it. And then you take a chilled coupe or martini glass, and you rinse a little absinthe in the glass, and then you dump it out. And that just gives it almost more of an aroma than a taste.
Poor absinthe. It always gets dumped.
It always gets dumped. I know. I know. We've done the Sazerac on this show, and we've done the Corpse Reviver number 2. And
well, we keep trying to use the ingredients that we've gotten you to buy, so...
Yes. 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 So. And also, like, just a... You know, the absinthe we use is about a million proof. And, yeah, you want to dump it.
You don't want to drink it.
You don't... You know, even just the smell of it will start your car. But it is sort of it's the French 75 is sort of adult lemonade. This is adult country time with a little bit more complexity.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it has it's somewhere at the Venn diagram intersection of an aviation, a last word, and the other one you just said.
Well, it's in the gin sour family, but it's the Cointreau that makes it interesting.
Yeah. And the absinthe too. I mean.
Yeah, and the absinthe too. And so you would not want to have the absence of absinthe.
I'd say
you'd
that.
Want the presence.
The presence.
You'd want the presence of absinthe. And so, that's a good time, I think, to stop.
Yeah. Well, I want to say that from description, it probably sounds awful, but it actually is a lovely, refreshing, complex, slightly bitter, not sugary sweet.
No, not
cocktails.
At all.
Yeah, I think it's very much in the mold, as you say, of a last word. Yeah. So if you like that recommendation, we did too. And by the way, pro tip on a lot of these somewhat odd ingredients like Cointreau, go to a big liquor store and you can get it in nips, which is a classic baking trick, right? So they're like, and a little bit of Chambord, and you don't want like that giant scepter
orb of Chambord.
That you can get a little nip of Chambord and then just use it for that. So,
and we actually got one of those for Cointreau because we don't go through a lot of Cointreau in this house.
No, in fact, I think it's the first time we've ever bought a Cointreau.
It is.
Because we usually order this when we go out, we don't make it. But we've made it for you.
We've made it for you. And we're going to clink our glasses here, free noters. And that's going to bring to a close this sequel. And we may or may not do another sequel in the future. But on next week's episode of The Free Noter, it's time to look at actionable takeaways. How do we empower audiences to go actually do something with our talks?
We'll look at the work of Brian Fanzo, Press the Damn Button, and the simple action he leaves everyone with, which I just told you.
She did just tell you that. And we're also going to have one of our new favorite cocktails. It's been around, but it's new to us. The Paper Plane.
All that and more on next week's episode of The Free Noter.
Cheers.
Cheers.